2014 fellowship morning sessions in Westside.
Yeah, I saw like, it was, okay, I'm with you.
So that means the mic.
Testing. He turned it off so I can talk. Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3.
Hey, everybody. Let's start to get settled into our seats. I couldn't think of that last word for a moment there. Seats. JR, really nice of you to join us this morning. Thank you. I just want to announce I've got a little something to share with everybody this morning. I know we've had chocolates brought in and alcohol in the back. There's a little something called Visine, so if any of my music night friends are in need, I have a little bottle up here for you. Helps me out through my days. Just up here as a reminder, we're into Wednesday. I don't remind you we're into Wednesday. This is how bad we've gotten. So the multi-stakeholder model, I have back up on the screens again. Yesterday we had constituency day, of course, and I think we might warn you maybe a bit too much about the day, but I love last night. We did our rapid fire around for the download, and it made me feel like it wasn't that way for all of you at all. I mean, yes, a bit overwhelming and stressful a bit and anxious of things that you don't know. But on the other hand, you know, the other words of hopeful and excited and, well, of course, Bruno's always excited, but just all the words you're using to describe yesterday made me feel that, you know, the day was valuable to you. So just to put up here as a reminder of the different groups you've come in contact with this week, the generic name supporting organization, with our contracted and non-contracted parties. So the registries and the registrars are the non-contracted parties, if you might have gone into their rooms yesterday. The internet service providers, the intellectual property constituency, the commercial and business users constituency, the non-commercial stakeholder group, with the non-commercial users constituency and the not-for-profit organizational concerns. So those are all with generic top-level domains. So when you hear those names, those communities, that's all generic top-level domains. That's their interest. That's what they do. Okay. So again, we've got Wednesday and Thursday to still be talking to people and thinking about when you're in the sessions. And I just wanted to once again give that reminder. Back on Tuesday, Byron Holland was with us from the Country Code Naming Supporting Organization, the CCTLDs, Country Codes, specifically about country codes, though discussing similar policies. So just a different perspective. Not everything is as important, but everyone, again, around the tables are discussing some of the same major policies and initiatives and concerns, but just from a different perspective. So we're going to continue, and the Government Advisory Committee, don't let me forget Tracy's presentation to us yesterday. So again, governmental concerns. Those who went to the GAC and board session yesterday got a little taste of the things that are on the minds of the various government representatives around the table. And that's why the board meeting is a really good spot to land. So this morning, we are going to have a nice conversation due to your questions that you provided ahead of time through Alejandra. So thank you again, Ali, for doing that for the second time. To the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, the Chair, Patrick Fahlstrom, who is here trying to finish his food. I can see to the left, just as I might start to introduce him. And Patrick, I actually have two things ready for you. One is the the set of questions, although a little small. Okay, good. But we also have your site. So if you had wanted to get into your set at all, we can do that too. And let me pass over to you.
Thank you very much, everyone, and good morning.
Good morning. Good
morning. Oh, yes, we're the fellowship. Good morning, everyone. When I say that in any other group, I say good morning, people are like, rawr, rawr, don't disturb me, I'm having coffee. So anyway, thank you very much for having me here again. I actually think it's the third time that Alejandra and you helped me with questions before I come here. And that, of course, is always a good thing, because it helps not only me but also you to think a little bit about in what context we're going to have this discussion. So I hope all of you now tune your brains to the mindset of security and stability. Okay, so there. So the Security and Stability Advisory Committee of ICANN was created in 2001, and it was created due to, among other things, the events on on September 11, when most of the world started to understand that not all of us are as nice as we are here in the fellowship. There are people out there which intentionally really try to destroy the world that we are living in. Before that, of course, since ICANN was created, there had been a lot of discussions regarding various different kind of problems that we see on the internet, where people trying to do denial of service attacks, they're trying to put up false websites, they try to steal credit cards account and whatnot. But in 2001, ICANN board took the decision to start with create a board advisor, just a board security committee, but it didn't take many months before they actually was formed as a formal advisory committee. Advisory committees do report to anyone they want, but to the board is the most important party. So ICANN board can ask us questions, and we are, by our charter, we are required to respond to those questions. But we can get questions from anyone. On the other hand, we only have time to respond to maybe 4 to 8 questions a year. It takes us about half a year normally to respond to a question. And the response that we give is in the form of documents. So if you scroll down a little bit, in the left-hand menu you see documents, if you click on that one. No, to the left. Just click on documents.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Up, 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 up. There. Down, 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 down. There.
I can't multitask this morning.
Okay, this was also very small print. But anyways, so here you can see the documents that we have published. The latest report, number 68, so that is the total number of reports we have published. That was actually published on Sunday this week. So we were working really hard even while flying over here to make sure that this document was ready. The two last documents, number 67 and 68, are related to the IANA transition. And these two might actually be kind of interesting for you to read, because what we are trying to do in those two is to describe in 67 what IANA is, what the IANA function is, and what the IANA part of ICANN actually is doing. As far as we know, that description is never written down before. And it also describes the history of IANA, why IANA exists. So that document has been received pretty well. Number 68 that we released now this weekend, it goes through the contract that U.S. government do have with ICANN and describes what the contract covers. Because there is a difference between what IANA is doing and what the contract is describing. And part of the problems in the discussion that you hear going on in the corridors and whatnot is that, first of all, people disagree on what IANA is or what it's doing. But even if they do know, it depends on whether you're looking at it from the contract perspective or from the perspective of what IANA actually is doing. So those are sort of two examples of reports that we are writing. You see that on the slide, if you have really good eyes, you see that it says English there as a clickable link. If you scroll down a little bit, there. You see there is one document down there, number 58, which you see exists in multiple languages. And this is something that we now start to do with 67 and 68, is that we, with 67 and 68, both of them will be available in all UN languages. They have just not had time to do the translation yet. So, on the other hand, I did, together with ICANN board, manage to decide on Saturday, this last Saturday, that the translation should be expedited, and I'm promised that one of the reports at least should be ready before October 20. And that is just because International Telecommunication Union, ITU, is starting their plenipot in Busan in Korea, and it's pretty important that people there can get a document on what IANA is before the conference starts. So that's a little bit about ESSAC. To go back to one of the questions that we got is, how is the membership of ESSAC? And the membership involves people that are appointed on three-year terms. And so one third of the members are reviewed every year, and it's decided whether they are allowed to continue or not, whether they have done their homework, whether they are coming for breakfast, whether they are showing up at the conference calls, and whether they have time. Because none of ESSAC members, including myself, do get paid. We all donate the time that we, for the work. ESSAC members are appointed by the rest of ESSAC. So if it is the case that someone would like to become a member of ESSAC, you fill out a form, you go through an interview, you got we have a membership committee that is looking at the skill set of the person, and then the individual get approved by the rest of ESSAC. We have 40 members in ESSAC. So we are a small committee. So when we are meeting, we are like normally half the group of what you have here in this room, and all of us as ESSAC, this is probably about 40 people, I would guess, or 20 maybe. Yeah. Anyways, so we're 40 people, so we are not that many. And so as I said, you can become a member just by applying and then passing the interviews and things. And now, of course, everyone say, oh, you must be so good at DNS to be able to be a member of ESSAC. But it's actually not true. At the moment, we do have many people that do know, or at least have a little bit of knowledge about DNS, like myself. So we don't need more people that know DNS. We need people that know other things, like IP packets. We have the last couple of members that we have. The last member, by the way, that we just appointed is a person that was working for the Serious Organized Crime Agency in the UK. And he was the one working with many of the botnets that have been taken down the last couple of years. So of course, he knows lots about computers, but he is a really operational law enforcement person. African region. Well, ESSAC work worldwide. That said, and we try to take up issues that are related to, as I said, we can only work with 8 things a year. So we really need to look at global issues. That said, of course, we need to know what's going on in multiple parts of the world. So we are trying to look at geographical diversity in the membership, in our membership review. I was just, so And just because we rotated members, it depends a little bit on what year, how many individuals we do have from ESSAC, from, for example, Africa. I just checked our list of members, and we have 2 members from Africa at the moment, where one of them, by the way, is from, originally from the fellowship. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, 2, but one left you.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But at the moment, there are 2 members from Africa to be very explicit on responding to that question. And then depending on what you count with Africa, we also have 1 person from Israel that in some cases is sort of treated like somewhat that region, even though it's not part of the African continent. Let's see. The functions of IANA, if I look at question 4.1, I actually think that you should read document SAC 67 to understand the various functions. And in 68, we're going through the contract and pointing out explicitly what functions IANA is required to perform due to the contract itself. Regarding a parallel internet, a lot of people are talking about that, but I, first of all, don't think it is. Of course, it's technically feasible, but I don't think the amount of funding exists to be able to try to build something completely new. And on top of that, even the internet was not built from nothing. Internet started by leveraging the telecommunication infrastructure, which Tony Holmes, that just entered the room, that is after me, I actually met him at ITU conferences the first couple of times when we were doing internet over telecommunications infrastructure. So I remember myself when I started to build internet in Sweden in 1987. That's when I started. And I'm not that old. I started as really young, or maybe both. Well, anyway. So in 1987, I started, and what we did was to run IP over X25, like old telecommunication infrastructure. After about 1.5 years, we found that was not very efficient, and the amount of internet traffic did grow really, really fast. So the connection we had from Scandinavia to the United States, which was where internet was, and we were number 3 in the world to have an internet connection, that was a 56 kilobits per second satellite link from Scandinavia to the United States that carried all traffic from all over Northern Europe, 56 kilobits per second. So after about 1/2 year, we had to upgrade that and bought a second link. Woohoo! But after a while, we saw that running things over X25 was not so efficient. So we swapped and started to run X25 over IP, and the telco people that were using the cables together with us didn't notice. They actually thought that their communication ended up being much faster. So we swapped one evening, instead of running internet over telecommunication, we run telecommunication over internet. So if it is the case that something new is created, I think it will start to run over the internet. And to some degree, that's what we are seeing with Facebook and applications and over-the-top services. That is what people today think are internet, is internet. So I think there is an evolution going on all the time. Let's see. You talk about, I see here, an L root server on the Marshall Islands. Well, it is possible to get root servers on from any of the letters by contacting them. For example, I work for NetNode in Sweden, and we run iRoot and the letter I, which is one of the root name servers. And many of us, including L, which ICANN is operating, iRoot, that we are operating from Sweden, you can contact any of us and ask whether we are interested in locating a root server wherever you would like to have it located. Each one of us root server operators have different policies for location of them. We from NetNode, we only provide root servers at internet connect points where we can directly peer with as many other parties as possible. We are currently peering in the world with maybe 5,000 different operators. We could peer with up to about 13,000 if only the operator was interested to peer with us. I don't understand why an operator connected at an internet connect point is not interested in talking with us, but anyways, that's their problem. So if you want to have an LRoot instance, you have to talk to the people at ICANN to see how interested they are. If you want an iRoot, you talk to me. Then there was a question whether ESSAC provide tools and trainings. We are not doing that, but we're working together with the security department here in ICANN, and they are doing various different kind of trainings. I also would like to refer very much to the work that the regional internet registries, the RIRs, and Internet Society is doing. That in those organizations, you have much, much more outreach than what you have here in ICANN. But as I said, there's very good cooperation. So there are a lot of ESSAC members which participate in those training courses. For example, and this goes back to engagement in Africa region, we at NetNode has been doing quite a lot of outreach and IX work in Africa with deployment of root servers, for example, in Rwanda, which is the last one that we have built, and we're working on also infrastructure in Kenya. But for example, in the work that we're doing together with Internet Society in Rwanda, we have quite a lot of work with training and such things. And then the question is whether someone from ESSAC want to be present when you have some kind of event, for example, when a root server is being installed. Of course, I'm happy to reach you via me. I can reach out to the ESSAC members and see whether one of them is able to be present. Of course, cannot promise anything, but I'm happy to pass messages and invitations to the ESSAC members if you want to. Next slide, please.
In the meantime, if I can say this, one of our RP participants, Bukola, asked if you could be more specific with the engagements from Africa and probably the countries. The countries you mentioned specifically were outside of Africa.
Well, I only mentioned one country, and that was Israel. And yes, I did notice that is, of course, not part of Africa. You can see yourself on the website on the ESSAC members. We have two members from Africa, and you can see that. But it doesn't really matter what country really people are coming from. And as I said, we in ESSAC don't do any specific work in any region in the world, not in Africa, not in Europe, not in North America either. I got a second letter from Ale with more questions as well.
Sorry, baby.
One question is how we are interacting with other ICANN stakeholder groups and external sister organizations like IETF and IEEE. The interaction we have with other groups here in ICANN is that we are an advisor committee to them, so the other groups can ask us questions and then we respond to them. But it's also possible for us to send them a message or a letter without having them asking us a question if it is the case that we feel there is need for that. For example, in the GNSO that Janice just described that deal with generic top-level domains, we have written a number of advisories and documents that are related to work they're doing without them having asking us any questions. What else? External organizations like IETF and IEEE, we don't have any relationship with them as ESSAC, but we have many members of ESSAC which have core positions in many of those organizations, specifically the IETF. Then the question is what the main security concern is regarding internet stability. We believe that there are specifically, let me mention a few. We don't really rank them, but a few that we are working on. One is an issue that we wrote about already in report number 4, and that has to do with the lack of what we call, which is ingress filtering, and that has to do with the ability today for people that are connected to the internet, like my laptop, to send IP packets with other IP addresses as a source address than my own. This is something that the whole world that work with security think that it's wrong for ISPs to allow end users to send IP packets with a different sender IP address than the IP address that they have been assigned. But the ability to spoof IP packets is one of the worst problems that we have. What can be done with it? Well, if it was the case that I knew, in that case, I would absolutely make sure that that happened. We don't know. But it's a really big issue. The second, another issue which is close to domain names has to do with domain name hijacking. And the most common way of doing hijacking of domain names today is by breaking into the registrar or the registry where you have registered your domain name. And unfortunately, there are too many registries and registrars which have the usernames and passwords stored in clear text in the database. So by managing to attack and break into the registry or the registrar system, it might be possible change the owner or redelegate domain names. And we had a pretty nasty incident just last week in the CCTLD that affected quite a large number of users, which is not good. So I think those two are probably the two most important ones. The third one that I will mention, because you will, if you haven't heard anything about it yet, read your newspaper this morning. It has to do with HTTPS and security and encryption in TLS. It was released yesterday, about 12 hours ago, information that SSL version 3 is subject to the ability to attack SSL version 3. And everyone is encouraged to reconfigure their boxes to no longer support SSL version 3. I did that with my computers this morning, and I hope that the reason why some people might not be here is because they're working with their computers, because this is really serious. It was disclosed by having a document published that tell people how to break into things that are protected with SSL version 3. So you just follow the instructions and you're done. Pretty bad. So that is sort of connected to the whole TLS certificate issues, where myself and many others are trying to encourage people to start to use a technology using DANE, which is an extension to DNSSEC. And we need that because we need to stop using X509 certificates and CA chains. So today, you probably buy a certificate from a CA to protect your website. That is something we must stop do that and instead deploy DANE. But on the other hand, we cannot use DANE before people both have signed their zones and are validating. So as you understand, there's quite a lot of things to do. But until we have done so, we will have many, many, many more problems that are related to cryptography, including things like this SSL version 3 issue. Before I let you who have the microphone to answer, let me just be clear here. The SSL version 3 issue would not have been resolved by having DNSSEC or DANE. It is a problem that we have just because SSL version 3 is an old standard. It is just vulnerable. People have found a way of a backdoor in that, and it's just wrong to continue to still use it. So there is no relationship between the two, but we see an enormous number of attacks using this kind of thing. You might have heard about Heartbleed, for example. That was a problem in OpenSSL. So this is the second one. So we will see many of those. So with that, let's open up for a few questions until Tony has finished his breakfast and can come here.
I was going to say, Tony, if you had any comment too, we have a couple mics to what we were talking about, internet service providers. So please feel free to also raise your hand if you have a comment to Patrick. JR?
Hello, this is Jang Yursen from Bangladesh. Actually, I'm a fan of ESSEC report. I read most of the report already last 3 months. And this was awesome report, ESSEC 067 report. It's really clear me to how IANA function and how IANA do. Before this report, I was a little bit complexity about how I know this actual information of IANA functionality and internal agreement issue. But when I read the ESSEC 067 report, it makes me clear. And I am very much thanks to ESSEC group of member who make the ESSEC report all time. Second thing,
thank you very much.
And second thing, I have a comment regarding you. I already told you ITU X25 protocol and their previous history. Yes, I am too, because the ITU X25 protocol, there is a lot of some legislation in considering some technical and financial aspect by compared to TCP/IP. So that TCP/IP become now popular and implemented in global internet level. Sengkong, my question is, since you are a member of ICG, can you please share me some initial outcome of ICG? Thank you.
Yes, I am a member of the coordination group ICG. I'm actually one of the co-chairs. We don't have any outcome of the ICG, but what we have done so far is that we have issued an RFP, a request for proposal, where we ask the operational communities for names, numbers, and protocol parameters to send to us their proposal for the transition, and we have requested those proposals to be delivered to us no later than January 15 in 2015. The second thing we have been doing, apart from, of course, bureaucracy and our own charter and other kind of things, is that we have issued an RFP for an independent secretariat that we are currently in the middle of a procurement process for procuring that secretariat. And so we have a secretariat that is independent of ICANN. We will have an open session on Thursday between 10 and 12, if I remember correctly. Yes, between 10 and 12 in Los Angeles, we have an open session where you will hear from us and what is going on in the ICG for the ones that are interested in. And then for people that are really interested, we have a working session all of Friday. And that session do allow silent observers. So it is possible to sit in the room. It is translated to all UN languages. It is broadcasted over the internet. And we will have seats for maybe 60 people in the room. So the 61st person's coming there. I don't know why people want to sit to watch silent without being able to say anything. Look at us sitting around the table working. But anyways, some people might be interested in that. So I recommend you to come on Thursday.
JR, we need to have a mic on you. So is this a follow-up to what you just said?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll let you get away with that.
Hello, can you please send me that time schedule of Friday meeting? If it is open, then may I participate on this meeting to learn something? Friday meeting?
The audio in the room is pretty, pretty crappy. There are no speakers for me. So can you repeat and speak more slowly?
You told me that there is a meeting on Friday. So is this meeting is open for all?
The meeting on Friday is open for all, but you are not allowed to speak in the room. You can sit there and listen in to what we are doing and saying. But you cannot participate in the meeting, but the room is open.
Okay, thank you.
While we're going over to comment from Albert from the remote room, Mamadou Lo from Senegal, how is the ESSAC involved in the IANA transition process? Does the ESSAC have a specific role actually regarding security and stability in this process?
We don't have any specific role more than the role that all the AC and SOs have. We are invited, just like everyone else, to appoint people to, for example, the ICG. So we appointed two persons. I am one of them, and I ended up being the co-chair, partly maybe because people would like to have people outside of the policy developing processes trying to run the whole process itself, if you understand what I mean. So it ends up being a little bit more neutral. So that's our role. Let me just add one detail about, like, it might sound a little bit harsh that you are not allowed to speak on Friday. It is a working meeting for us. So for many other groups here, they have working meetings which are completely closed. It's also the case that the mailing list that we have, the archives are open. So you can look at all our internal email messages. So you can see exactly what we're discussing. It's actually kind of interesting to run a process where everyone can read every email that you read and write, including inside an organization. If you want to participate, that is this Thursday session. On the Thursday session, we will have an open microphone and discussion, just to make that clear. Thursday open, Friday closed.
Albert,
Daniels, ICANN Global Stakeholder Engagement Manager for the Caribbean. I just wanted to support what Patrick said about capacity building in the regions, particularly the Caribbean region. The ICANN staff, and I see Rick Lam is here over at the end, the security staff get involved in doing presentations and workshops when invited to in different territories in the region. And also, as Patrick mentioned, the regional internet registries. In the case of the Caribbean, there are two that serve us, both LACNIC and ARIN. And just last week, we were in Curacao at the Caribbean Network Operators Group, where both of those RIRs were doing capacity building sessions on security, IPv6, and so on. So I presume that there are similar sessions in other regions, so those who are interested can find out what is going on and take advantage of that type of capacity building.
Okay, thank you. Pierre from Benin. I've just heard earlier that you have only two members from the whole Africa. So I'm surprised. Africa is not a country. So what is your strategy to help African people to be aware of what is going on with ASAC? Because I think it is very, very important that the security issues should be brought to everybody.
There are three things that we are trying to do. The first thing that we are trying to do is that we are trying to work really, really hard, for example, to work together with you here fellows, that I'm putting quite a lot of energy working with Janice to make sure that the fellowship program continues, and me being here to tell all of you that ASAC exists. So we are trying to do as much awareness as possible, first of all, because if people don't know that ASAC exists, they will not apply. Okay. The second thing is that we are trying to, we just this week started to do video interviews with me and other ASAC members that will be published on the ICANN webpage about ASAC, and so we are using the ICANN communication channels to let people know what ASAC is. The next thing we are trying to do is that we are, as ASAC members, we are trying to say yes to as many invitations that we can that we get from specifically outside the world. Now, the problem there is, as always, when you are dominated with people from one region, that is very hard for them to travel outside their own region. But we also so we are working together, like we just said, the RIRs and others, to try to get people to understand what we're doing. The next thing that we are trying to do is to is also do more outreach and for example, translation of documents. The problem, one of the problems that we do have, though, is that we have lost also a couple of people that are not from North America, and that is something that that concerns me. And with losing, I mean that even though a person is a member of ASAC for 3 years, after about 1 year, they stop responding to email, they don't participate on the mailing list. So one thing that I am trying to do is to increase the percentage of the ASAC members to ensure that they are continuing to work and be interested. But that is also sometimes a little bit hard to do, given the cultural differences. So yes, it is absolutely a problem that we don't have so many. For example, we have the same issue from Latin America. I think at the moment we have one person from Latin America. We have four people from Asia. So that's where we are. And the best thing we can do is, for example, I ask all of you, specifically you in Africa, to talk with your peers and try to encourage them to request membership.
And I know we had one more question, but we actually are quite a bit over time now, and I want to respect Tony's time this morning to be here, and as well as Patrick's to have to get to the next. So, Sonam, if you'd like to meet Patrick at the door to ask him, you can ask Patrick your question at the door as he's going. Please do so. Again, anyone who has questions for Patrick, other than trying to catch him as he's running to his next thing this morning, is to send them to me. And I'll make sure that he gets the questions, and he's amazing at getting answers back on a timely basis. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, everybody. I think I'll have to have a word with Janice, because following Patrick is always a hard task. So maybe I can change that. But it's a pleasure to be here with you. And I look on this as one of the really important parts of the ICANN meeting, certainly for us. As Patrick said, we actually met some years ago in the ITU, and at that time I was working for BT, and I was involved in their strategic direction, particularly on the naming and addressing side. And it's been an amazing journey for me since then, being involved since the very start of ICANN right through to now, with many changes. And I think I've seen it all, from the days when people used to say, this voice over IP thing will never catch on, and no one's ever going to trust the internet, to where we are today. And certainly looking ahead for the next 20 years, it's people like you that are really going to shape the internet. And it's going to be a very, very exciting and challenging time, I think, for everyone. So I chair the ISP and Connectivities Providers constituency. And I was very pleased at the meeting we had yesterday, our constituency meeting, to see a number of you turn up. You're very welcome to join us, and we certainly all benefit from that. With the ISPs, we sit within the commercial stakeholder group of ICANN currently, and so we share that space with the intellectual property constituency and the business constituency. And with those constituencies, we have many things in common, but we also have many diverse views as well. And certainly there's been a lot of discussion during this ICANN meeting as to how we can improve that situation and make it work better. Because we've struggled over the last couple of years, where more and more the focus of ICANN has been so much broader. A lot of cross-community working groups have originated. And very often on those, to keep them of a manageable size and funnel the input through those various topics, we find that in the commercial stakeholder group, we have just one representative. Now, that's a really tough call. When you have people with very diverse views and you have one person to put a channel into those discussions, it becomes very, very challenging. So that's something we're struggling with now. But being more parochial and looking at our particular constituency, it's open to anybody who qualifies as an internet service provider or a communications provider. So we're really involved in the infrastructure side of the business. And that also brings tensions within our particular constituency as well, very much because of the diverse makeup within the constituency. And as many of you will be aware, that a lot of the focus for ISPs is to get out there, to build the infrastructure that underpins the network, to grow the internet as well. And they come from a very focused technical background. So when you want to get involved in the policy aspects, quite often you'll find that those engineers that we really need to roll this stuff out and build the internet, they very, very quickly run away when you mention policy. So one of the things that we've done recently is to try within the ISP constituency to gear our efforts and our interaction with those parties down a particular stream that helps them engage. So how are we doing that? Well, we're setting up a new approach where the technical issues for the ISPs will be channeled down a technical stream, and we will have focused activities around those technical aspects, as well as separate mailing lists and outreach activities. The policy side of the debate that we're all involved in isn't going to go away and is equally important, but it's making sure as a constituency that we interact with the appropriate people in those organisations. And policy and technical realisation really does come together with the ISPs, because if you think about the expansion of the namespace, the introduction of the new GTLDs, what does that really mean for ISPs, and when does it hit home? And the easy answer is, well, when that stuff actually goes into the root and becomes operational. Because ISPs are always the first port of call whenever anything goes wrong. So you may buy a domain name from a registrar, and certainly you can gear your activities around that. But if it doesn't work, you don't go back to the registrar. You normally ring the ISP. So one of the things that we have been very proactive in is trying to make sure that across the globe, we actually get that message out there. We make sure ISPs, large and small, are aware of what's happening in ICANN and how it impacts them. Because it would be very remiss of us if we got to a stage where things started happening, good or bad, and they didn't have that knowledge. Now, they're easy words, but it's quite a challenging thing to do. And I would say we've probably been moderately successful in achieving that. We work a lot through the representative organisations of the ISP. So we work with the ISPRs and other groups. South America, we have some quite focused activities. We've also done quite a lot of outreach in those regions. But there is still work to do, particularly in some of the key areas of the world. Africa, for instance, is now under the spotlight for us, and we want to increase the engagement with ISPs in Africa. So we've put a lot of work into doing that. And when we go out to those places, we have to tell them what is key for them, why they need this level of engagement, and actually show them how we can help. So the sort of things that we focus on are things that impact back to the ISPs in a very focused manner. So things like name collisions, that was an issue that we became very concerned about. Anything that has the potential to challenge the technical realization of the internet. Another thing that we are really focused on now is the issue of universal acceptance. And during our meeting yesterday, we discussed what was happening with the introduction of some of the new domain names, where there are problems. Now, a lot of those problems are not specific to ISPs. For instance, the sort of things that we talked about yesterday were where there were various websites, and you may want to register for something or the other. So you put in your email address, and it's appended with a new domain name at the end, and it doesn't work. It isn't recognised. Now, a lot of the issues around that are with the software manufacturers. Some of them need to update their software so that they recognise these domains. But the impact back on us is that as an ISP, you need to be aware of what the problems are so that when your phone actually rings, you can actually help people. Even if you can't resolve it, you need to have an awareness of everything that's really happening there. So there are specific issues within ICANN that are very focused towards ISP activities. But in saying that, we're also very engaged in some of the broader issues that are being discussed here. IANA stewardship is certainly a key one for ISPs. And there are the three threads in there, as I'm sure you're aware. There is the protocol and parameter issues. There are the IP addressing issues, and there are the naming issues. And all of those are incredibly important for ISPs. So we engage in some aspects of that in the other fora, in IETF, for instance, where a lot of the work on the protocol parameter stuff is being done. And, of course, in the regional internet registries. Because at the end of the day, IP addresses, it's really the lifeblood for ISPs. If we don't have access to IP addresses, then we have no access to customers. So a lot of focus there. And the naming side, I think you should certainly be aware, having been involved in ICANN now, of how important that is as well. So again, there are some areas where we've still yet to make good strides. The introduction of IPv6 has not been a particularly happy story. I think it could have been introduced in a far slicker way than it has, and there are still challenges there trying to grow that area as well. DNSSEC falls into a similar category as well. And despite the efforts of groups like the SSAC that you just heard from Patrick to try and introduce those in a way that it provides a secure, better and safer environment, it hasn't always been taken up as readily as it could. So in terms of where we're going, I mentioned that we have quite a focus on outreach. We produce newsletters, and I think we're one of the first groups in ICANN that actually produce them in any other language than English. Somewhat accidental, we happen to have members who speak Spanish and who speak French, so we're very limited, but they certainly saw the importance of this, and we have had links on our website to the updated news in those languages, so a little bit ahead of the game there. But again, still an awful lot to do. We've also had some discussions with ICANN recently about how we can involve more people across the globe. And we now have an arrangement whereby if we identify particular events that are happening where there is an ISP presence and we have some concerns about growing the reach of ICANN into those regions, then we have the ability now to go to those events and actually do some outreach, do some explanation, run some workshops, and look at broader engagement. So one of the pleas I will make to you today is that if you do have any association with ISPs and connectivity providers, even if it isn't from a personal perspective, please put us in touch with those and either contact me or through Janice, you can actually make those links together. So I look on this as a two-way event, really, because I get an awful lot back from this group, and I hope we can provide a better understanding of how things are happening and what's important from our perspective to you. So at that stage, I should probably pause and ask if there are any specific questions so far.
Great. If we can have the mics, please, guys. Excuse me. Hi. Guys, excuse me, Tex, hi. Sorry. I've had a really rough morning, as you well know, so I am quite understanding. We have a question over here. Thank you so much. We have a couple, one, two. Amat, I see you in the back, although I'm not sure I recognize you. I was just going to say, I get to listen to this three times a year normally, and every single time my pen is up because I'm thinking about one more thing. As soon as Tony or Patrick or a speaker is talking. And I think we often forget, when I talk to you about the nominating committee or something and I say, it doesn't have to be you. It's somebody that you know that you think, wow, this would be the right person and get their voice. I think I forget to say that about our supporting organizations, advisory committees, stakeholder groups, and constituencies. It might not be you, but you're the carrier. And I know we kind of ask you to do more than you're even doing, and with busy workloads and family lives and things, but that's part of ICANN, it's part of the volunteer spirit. But we're really asking you to think and say, can I go back to my Chamber of Commerce? Can I go back to, you know, the internet service providers, find a connection to a connection, and start to make them aware, get the collateral off of our websites, off of the sites of our community groups, and just start to bring the presence. I just made a quick note down here saying to myself, I'm getting Chris Modini in my head now because he's teaching me so much about putting things together. If you are attending an IGF, if you're attending an ITU, if you're attending an event, think about, can I bring someone with me and introduce them there? And I know funding's always an issue. Can I bring someone with me? Or if not, find out from me or looking at the attendee list, who else from ICANN is there? What are the community groups? Patrick's going to be at the ITU, could be at an IGF, and go there and make the next connection again. You know, how can I help further? We talk to the fellowship, what can I do? So I think I sometimes forget to talk to you about the ripple and ripple. Esteban?
But if I could just build on that while we're thinking about that, one thing I didn't say, which you brought to my mind that I think is very relevant, is I'm always keen to explain that involvement in ICANN and involvement in the ISP constituency, it doesn't mean you have to come to every ICANN meeting. In fact, some of our members rarely come. Some of them have come to one ICANN meeting and they get hooked, but they're very small ISPs. They're struggling with their day-to-day work, building infrastructure. They can't travel across the globe. They haven't got the time and they haven't got the resources. But they hook on to the ISPs, and through that, we have a direct channel with them. We can keep them up to date. We can increase that level of awareness. So That's another message that I'll ask you to carry, is involvement doesn't mean you have to turn up at every ICANN meeting. It doesn't have to be inherently expensive either. But just put the channels in place, and that flow of information is there. And that should be of benefit, as I say again, to us and to those who are receiving it as well. Sorry.
Hi, I am Esteban Lescano from Argentina. Thank you, Tony, for coming and explaining how works the constituency. My question is, do you think that the universal service and the extension of the broadband in the, for example, developing countries could be an issue to be treated in the ISP, in the ISP constituency or not?
Probably specifically not, although we do have a lot of members who are engaged in that back home. One of the challenges we all face is that growth of infrastructure and making sure it grows in the right way and at the right rate. And the challenges vary across the globe as well. I think over the recent 4 or 5 years, for instance, in Africa, I think there's been some significant changes there. I know there's a lot of work put into that in your own region as well. In Europe, we've probably focused on it in a different way, and a lot of the debates now around about things like net neutrality and how that relates to the internet. There's no easy answers to that one. In fact, a number of us will leave this ICANN meeting and go on to the plenipotentiary meeting in Korea, where, once again, I think that those sort of issues are going to surface there as well. So no easy answers. I don't think there's anything we should be doing here in that arena particularly, other than if it impacts ICANN operations in any way, or what ICANN's responsible for. And I'm sure you've heard a number of times across the week that although it's a tremendously important role, the ICANN remit is very specific and very focused. So if it doesn't fall within that, then we wouldn't expand on that within the ISPs.
Yeah. Good morning. First of all, thanks for coming and speaking to us. This has been a really great session. I'm Chaitanya Ramachandran from India. And my question is about internet exchange issues. In India specifically, I think there's a spotlight at the moment on how ISPs are exchanging at internet exchange points. And domestic exchange points have not been very successful in India. And I think one of the issues that the government is looking at is legally mandating that all ISPs transit or peer locally. I believe at the moment many ISPs choose to do so outside the country. What's your view on a step like this? It hasn't happened yet, but it might happen in the near future, where the government legislates a mandatory local internet exchange. And if you're against it, what would be a good strategy for ISPs to oppose this? And is this the kind of thing that you might be working on in the ISP constituency?
Well, thank you for that. I've always been reluctant to support a path that goes down mandating particular issues on ISPs. Certainly, I'm aware in various parts of the world we've had those discussions about the introduction of IPv6. I think it's very difficult to get that equation right through mandating action. But at the same time, if there's a total reluctance to change things, and that's hampering the market, the growth of the internet in those countries, then again, you have to take some form of action that you can. For me, the right direction with that is to look to see if you can provide some form of initiative that actually stimulates the market to do the right thing. And I share the view very much that I think a great inhibitor to the growth of the internet has been the peering arrangements. It really is at the heart of so many problems for that growth. So it needs to be tackled. But actually mandating it, I believe, is the very last step. You have to try everything else to try and shape and change the market and encourage. And I think the introduction of IPv6 has highlighted that there are ways you can often do those things. If you look at the growth of IPv6, the regions of the world where it's been successful, It has been stimulated in other ways. It's not been mandated. But the type of actions that have been taken on IPv6, well, one of the key things for me is involvement of governments in that, not through mandating IPv6, but by making sure that they support it within their own infrastructure. So, for instance, whenever there are contracts to expand any part of the government network, I think making it quite clear that it needs to be at least IPv6 compatible has stimulated the market. So that they haven't had to invest a lot of money at the national level to do that, but they put in place arrangements that spark the market. And even in Europe, we're very much behind with IPv6 introduction in very many countries. And I think that the governments there have missed that opportunity. Certainly in some parts of Asia, it's really been successful because they've taken that approach. So I would like to think when we come down to the peering arrangements that every avenue is looked at and explored before you actually get to the level of imposing something on ISPs that can be very burdensome, can be very costly as well, really changes their fundamental business model in many ways for very good reasons, but let's look at other ways first. I hope that answers that.
Morning. Wanda from the Dominican Republic in the Caribbean. I used to work for the second ISP in the Dominican Republic for many years, and I also have relationship with all the Dominican Republic ISP because I am coordinating the IPv6 task force there. So I think I have the homework to go back to my country and try to contact all of them to get involved in this. I was thinking if there is any advice from you, for example, if you have a regional perspective where I can contact somebody from the Caribbean to coordinate any effort to try to involve Dominican Republic's ISP in this group.
Certainly, and I would suggest that maybe we can take this up offline. I'm sure it would be a great opportunity for us to have a dialogue with you and through you as well. So, yes, we do have people that can help you with that, and I'd be really pleased to follow up with you. And thank you very much. I really appreciate that offer. That was, from my perspective, that was a real benefit from coming here this morning. Thank you.
Definitely, we'll take that one. And also Albert Daniels, Wanda, as you know. So Albert certainly would be more than happy, and you know, maybe there is something we can work out all together between ICANN and the Internet Service Provider to maybe even provide a place to gather everyone. You know, it would take maybe a little bit of time to do, and maybe we get everybody together one place, and I can talk to Albert and see if we might be able to get some communication around that.
Thank you.
It'd be a good way to go. We're going to take one more, I believe, from a time perspective. Amata from the back.
Good morning. We recently...
Amata, could you please say who you are for the record?
I'm from the Marshall Islands. And we recently dual-stacked our routers and everything when we're IPv6 ready. And we tested it out going IPv6. And there were very few, I can say... few places we can go online, like CNN, just the major major internet players were available in IPv6. Can you explain more why it's not being embraced as much as, I guess, you guys envision?
Well, certainly I think that's chicken and egg, and we have exactly the same problem. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, I was lecturing on a course that was looking at the future of the internet. And we did exactly the same thing that you've done. It was in a hotel where the conference was, and basically we gave a demonstration where we switched to IPv6, and it was just as though the internet went dark. Very little content there. And until you get the bulk of people having that ability to utilize V6, the upgrade that's required in terms of getting the content out there just isn't happening. And it really is circular. It's totally chicken and egg. And it's something that's very, very difficult to change. My hope was that now we're at the stage where the V4 address space is exhausted, that was going to happen. But in many parts of the world, it's still not happening. And why? Because now, and I've been involved a little bit in this as well, where I've gone along to companies to talk about IP addressing, thinking they wanted to move to IPv6. And when I get there, what they say is, can you help us? We need to squeeze more out of this V4 address space. So they'll do anything other than make that move. And I don't think that's the right way to go. There are things you can do to expand the V4 space. Carrier grade NATS is the one that comes to mind easily. But it has some negative impacts as well. Some applications don't work if you adopt that sort of technology. But the crunchy point for IPv6 is that it allows you to expand your network, but it comes at a cost. And that's always been the issue that ISPs have struggled with, and I've struggled with that myself. You go along to a board of directors and say, we have to invest in IPv6. And they say, okay, what's it going to cost? Well, you can give them that information. And then they say, and what does it deliver? Well, it delivers a few additional things, and it enables you to expand your network, but it's a hard argument. And unfortunately, until you can get that shift, which is really a seismic shift, those issues are not going to go away. So I don't have an easy answer. I really share the problem. I think it's a great shame. We'll do everything we can to encourage that shift, but it's a tough call still, which is a very sad reflection on the industry, if I'm honest.
Yeah, and once again, I reminded how young we are. You know, we had a newcomer's day for the first time. We put in a series of slides that Calvin Wong, our stakeholder engagement manager for Asia, has been using. And it's just very simple, taking you back to the beginning, and Vince, of course, simplistic explanation at the end. But it's you were reminded all the time how young we are. And I think sometimes we have to pat ourselves on the back for getting as far as we have been in 16 years. But yeah, now is the time to go. You know, it's like you just, the horses have got to run loose, and we've got to use all the power of the 44 people here in this room, our largest fellowship ever. They're tiring me out, Tony. I'm old. and an alumni network of over 1,000. You know, so I've got to get better at capturing and harnessing the energy behind all of that. But it's really, you know, time, and, you know, we just have to take it. We've really got to take this opportunity to get out there and get the education. And sometimes it's a slow roll, you know, and you cannot get discouraged. It's just like this week. You know, I said this to someone earlier in the week, do not get discouraged. If your brain is tired at the end of the day, don't. Just get some sleep and come back at it. But it took me at least 3 or 4 ICANN meetings as a staff member to start to grasp some of these concepts. And embarrassingly enough, it took me even longer to understand a little bit about how to do my job, and I'm learning every single day how much more that I need to do. So take it in as it's coming. We don't expect you to go out there and save the world all at once, but start to think about how the ripple effect of the information that you're learning can help this move along. It's powerful, and I get excited every time I have an ICANN meeting week, because I just realize how powerful this is. But don't get discouraged. We've got tons of information. We've got amazing people like Tony out there who just can't wait to embrace you. And, yeah, it's going to be all good. I know there's some other questions, but we have Christina Rosette, who is kindly waiting back there with a cup of coffee, I hope, to come up and talk about the intellectual property constituency. So, Tony, I will get all these questions to you like we've done before.
Please do.
Of any follow-up. Wanda, if you want to just follow Tony outside for a minute, maybe you two can connect on how to connect.
Sure.
And then I've made a note to talk to Albert with both of you. Thank you so much, Tony.
Okay, well, thank you very much as well. And if you see me in the hallway and you have any more questions, happy to chat with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I have actually a PowerPoint from the pre-meeting. I can't find my webinar. Do you want it, or do you want to go without it? It doesn't make any difference.
I can do it, whatever you want.
Christine has given you a break to go get some coffee. Please. Thanks, Yuri. Thank you. Or some of the chocolates or cookies that came in. Everybody, could we please settle back down in our seats? We're ready to go. Hello, my good people.
We have one. Fabulous.
Guys, quickly, if I can get you to come back to your seats. The teacher in me comes out. We go from kind of nice to get your butt in your seat. Everyone, I'd like to introduce you to Christina Rosette. Christina is the chair for Intellectual Property Constituency, and you're already getting applauding out here, so this is a good sign. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, and thanks everyone for making time in what I know is a really busy schedule to hear from us. The Intellectual Property Constituency is one of the six constituencies of the GNSO. You probably have heard some of this before, but I think it bears repeating because it's a little hard to get your mind around initially. And that is the generic name supporting organization is divided into two houses, the contracted party house, which is the entities that have contracts with ICANN, and the non-contracted parties house, which are the entities that don't. Within the non-contracted parties house, you have two stakeholder groups, the commercial stakeholder group and the non-commercial stakeholder group. Within the commercial stakeholder group, there are three constituencies, the business constituency, the ISPs, you've just heard from Tony Holmes, their chair, and the intellectual property constituency, of which I am the president. Our primary objective, both as written in our bylaws, is to ensure that the views and interests of intellectual property owners are reflected in the policies developed by the generic name supporting organization, as well as in other activities of ICANN. When we say intellectual property, we truly mean all types of intellectual property. It's not just trademarks, it's not just copyrights, it's everything. And we have, the way that we are structured is that we have three categories of members. Category three members are international organizations like the International Trademark Association, the International Anti-Counterfeiting Coalition, ICIPI, FICP, some additional European and Asian Latin content owner associations. Category two members are national organizations. So, for example, the American Bar Association is one of our members. And then category one members are divided into two subgroups, individuals, and I'm actually a member as an individual capacity, and then organizations. So some of those organizational members are Marksman, which is a trademark investigation and acquisition company, or law firms. Some of the brand protection registrars like Mark Monitor and Cum Laude and CSC are also our members. So collectively, if you take all of our members, including those of our member organizations, we essentially represent almost 750,000 IP owners, IP service providers globally. And I think what I have found the most interesting aspect to our membership structure is that notwithstanding the fact that I am considered a Category 1B member, which means that I don't have as many votes as one of the big international organizations, you know, clearly the fact that I'm president of the IPC and have been now for 2 years indicates that you don't have to be associated with one of the big national international organizations, a national organization, a multinational corporation, anything like that. In terms of what we are working on now, the topics that have really been of interest to us here at this meeting have been things like, well, obviously, I think you've probably learned that everyone here is very concerned with the IANA stewardship transition and the ICANN accountability issues. But kind of setting those aside, some of the issues that we've really been focusing on are things like the efficacy of the rights protection mechanisms that have been required for this first round of new GTLDs. We have started planning and looking ahead to working with our members to hopefully do a global data collection project so that when it comes time for ICANN to begin its reviews of those rights protection mechanisms, that we are in a position to say, we received information from 20,000 trademark owners globally. This is the average number of trademark registrations they put in the trademark clearinghouse. This is the average number of Sunrise registrations they secured. This is the average price they paid for each Sunrise registration. This is how many trademark claim notices they've received and the like, so that we're really in a position to provide some meaningful quantitative input to this next review process. Some of the other issues that we have been looking at, and there are certain issues that have really been longstanding issues of concern to the IPC, for example, the compliance, and how effective is ICANN's compliance department in ensuring that the contracted parties are truly abiding by their contractual obligations. We've certainly seen some very significant improvements since I first got involved in ICANN 7.5 years ago. And certainly there are always ongoing improvements. For example, the fact that there's a new global compliance director who was announced on Monday, that's definitely a development that we welcome. We have a very open channel of communication with the folks in compliance that when we start to see trends developing that they may not be aware of, we have, you know, we'll reach out to them and say, you may want to start taking a look at this because we're getting a lot of feedback from our members about this particular issue that might be new. Another issue that is always something of concern to us is the entire who is process in terms of the accessibility and accuracy of that data. We have followed with interest the work of the expert working group that has recently completed its final report. We are very much very actively involved in the ongoing working group on proxy and privacy service providers. And that's actually a very interesting experience so far. Not surprisingly, you've got primarily three categories of participants, folks from the registrars and the proxy service providers, the IP folks, and then the non-commercial folks whose particular interest is free speech. And it's been really interesting to see how we've been able to, frankly, make some fairly significant progress on that. So those are really the issues that we're looking at. I am happy to take questions. Janice has got our website up. I think it's under the Join the IPC link. That drops down to our online membership application. We would welcome applications from anyone who's interested. I will say that it takes about 6 weeks to go through the membership process. We have a membership committee that makes initial evaluations. Sometimes it's necessary to reach back to the applicant and say, not really quite sure we understand this answer. Can you provide more detail? Then the membership committee makes its recommendations. Those are then sent on to the IPC Council, which is the category 2 and 3 members. And we generally give them two and a half weeks to review the applications and say, yeah, we support the recommendations of the membership committee, or, you know, we support this one but not that one, or we think we need to go back and get some more information. So we'd certainly welcome new applications. I just want to make sure that you all understand that it takes us a little while to get through our process. And finally, I would say probably the most important thing to keep in mind is that, and this is something that Janice touched on at the end of the previous presentation, be patient. Don't expect to come to ICANN and understand it all and know all the acronyms and understand how it all fits together your first time. I remember my first meeting, and I did a lot of faking, nodding, smiling, taking notes. And it was really only after the second meeting that I was starting to understand kind of, okay, I've heard this acronym before. I know what it means. Okay, I know what the CCNSO is now, and I know how it works, or at least I think I know how it works. And it's one of those things that, you know, at every meeting I learn something new. So please be patient and give it at least 2 meetings before you make a decision as to, oh, you know, I just can't do this. And with that, which I could certainly understand, it's very overwhelming. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Could we get our mics? I know you are riveted. The second meeting or third meeting might be remote. Okay, the fellowships, we're happy to say, there are 257 applications for this in Los Angeles. Out of that, 102 met the minimum requirements, and out of that, we're able to select 50. We had some losses for visa challenges. So everyone can't come back in each time under our 3-time rule of getting you rolled out. So go for the remote option. Same idea. You know, you're looking at what you're focused on. You're making sure that those sessions are watched if you want to interact in them. And then remember, everything's recorded. It's transcribed. Most of them are translated, almost all of them. So Adana up here, and then Jai. Oh, I say, Ben, I see you back there.
And actually, I'll just go ahead and add the remote from the perspective of somebody who generally does come to the meetings. You know, from time to time, there are things that, you know, I've got a personal obligation, I've got a job obligation, because frankly, this really has nothing to do with what I do every day at work, or at least not very much. So the remote participation that ICANN offers is really phenomenal. So, you know, please don't feel that you're really missing out if it turns out that you have to participate remotely, because it really is, they've done a fantastic job.
Hi, good morning.
Ben, I'm just going to start up here with Adana and then come back.
Hi, good morning. My name is Adana Burris. I'm a tenured law with the Ministry of Science and Technology. I also have a personal interest in intellectual property. I'm currently pursuing my master's in internet law and policy. I'm a first-time follower as well. I have two questions for you, ma'am. Thank you so much for your presentation. I'm interested in knowing what your Caribbean membership is like, first off. And secondly, I sat in on the IPC meeting yesterday. And as you guys were speaking about, as you were speaking about acronyms, I'm aware of what the Uniform Dispute Resolution Procedure is, but there was some reference to something called URS, and I didn't get an opportunity to ask because you guys were sort of cross-talking. So could you enlighten me on that, please?
In terms of the Caribbean membership, we have one membership application pending from a law firm in the Caribbean. It would be appropriate for me to tell you who it is. We do have two international organizations that cover Latin America and the Caribbean, ICIPI. And I apologize, I need to check my membership spreadsheet and I can get back to you, but they do cover the Caribbean Basin. The URS is the acronym for Uniform Rapid Suspension System. And what that is a process that was developed in connection with the development of the new GTLD program. And it's intended to be a faster and cheaper enforcement mechanism than the UDRP. So it really, what we were hearing from trademark owners are things like, look, I already have 400 domain names or 4,000 domain names, or in the case of Yahoo, 40,000 domain names. I don't want to do a UDRP and have more names transferred to me. I just want the domain name to be suspended. So the process is intended to, I think, start to finish. It generally takes about 14 days. The filing fee, I believe, is $500. And the evidentiary standard is higher. So it's really intended to be for those kind of clear-cut or, you know, to use an American phrase, slam-dunk cases where it's so clearly cyber-squatting. But the main distinction is that the only remedy is suspension of the domain name. You can't have it canceled. You can't have it transferred to you. It's suspended for whatever the remaining registration term is.
Hi, my name is Ben Town, and I have a question going back to the debate that was held, especially in the U.S., maybe a year or so ago, where a whole bunch of prominent copyright holders were looking to use the DNS system to go after copyright infringement with SOPA and PIPA and all that. And I was wondering if that came up in the constituency discussion and what kind of the result of that was and what's the perspective from the IPC about those sorts of approaches?
It didn't, because we don't focus on anything other than what's going on at ICANN. So we don't take positions on national legislation. We don't take positions on international treaty discussions, unless there is a very specific implication for ICANN's role in the DNS. So the view of our membership was that the SOPA-PIPA efforts were too far removed and had the additional characteristic of being very heavily national legislatively organized. And that's just, we don't think that's within our remit. And quite frankly, you know, as I think you've seen, there's a lot of work to do at ICANN, and it just, you know, even if we had consensus among our membership that it was appropriate for us to get involved in, we didn't have the bandwidth.
Good morning. My name is Chaitanya Ramachandran. I'm from India, and I'm an attorney in private practice. I have three quick questions. Number one, what are your membership criteria for law firms? Just like an overview, because it didn't sound like a simple sort of sign-up thing. It seems like you have detailed criteria. Number two, do you have mailing lists or newsletters that sort of newcomers to ICANN can sign up to. And I was my third question is, I was at the IPC meeting as well, and I heard many references to a trademark clearinghouse, but I didn't really understand what it was. So could you please explain that? Thanks.
Absolutely. The membership criteria, did you have a specific category, or were you just asking generally? For law firms, you essentially need to provide some brief information about the firm and identify what the firm's interest and expertise is in the area of intellectual property. It's not very complicated. In terms of, we do have a listserv for members. We're in the process of building one that would be more publicly accessible. We also have on our project list for Marrakesh is a newsletter about the IPC. Again, the rollout of new GTLDs has raised so many issues for us and our members that we really have had to kind of focus more on kind of putting the fires out as we see them. So projects that we very much want to do, like newsletters and the like, are things that we've had to put on the back burner. The Trademark Clearinghouse, or TMCH, is a database of authenticated trademark information. It's not a rights protection mechanism, but it is a essential feature of the two primary new rights protection mechanisms that came with the new GTLD program, the sunrise period and the trademark claims process. The way the Trademark Clearinghouse works is, if you want to secure, well, let's back up and say, if you want to participate in a sunrise period, you can only do so if you have entered the national trademark registration on which you want to base your sunrise registration into the clearinghouse and had it validated. Similarly, the Trademark Claim Service, which is really a notice process, is tied back to the particular trademark registration that's been entered. No. The TMCH is kind of a complicated technical structure. It's Deloitte does the user interface, and I have it bookmarked, so I don't know if, I think it's trademark-clearinghouse.com if you want to go and look at it. And IBM runs the underlying kind of technical structure of it. So the way this works is that if you want to enter your trademark registration into the clearinghouse, you can either do it two ways. One, as an individual trademark owner, or if you're doing it on behalf of someone else, you have to become an agent and then you have to sign a contract with them. And so you enter in the trademark data. You know, what's the mark, what are the classes of goods and services, when did it issue, when was it applied for, application registration number and the like. You have to provide a sample of use, of current use. That all then gets uploaded. The clearinghouse then has staff in, I think, every country, or relationships with people in every country, who can then check the accuracy of the data that you've entered against what's in the trademark office records for that particular country. So they're not validating in the sense of they're doing any kind of substantive examination of the quality of the trademark rights. They're really just checking, you know, is the mark really X? Is the owner X? Is the registration number X? And once that's done, they will then issue what is referred to as a signed mark data file, or SMD file, which the trademark owner then needs to provide to its registrar when it wants to participate in the sunrise process. And the whole purpose of the Trademark Clearinghouse was that trademark owners, the last time we had a whole bunch of new GTLDs, although, you know, we thought 20 was a lot back then, you were having to submit your trademark registrations over and over and over for each sunrise period to each registry. And the idea was that in a universe of however many new GTLDs we're going to end up having, that doesn't scale. So the way, once you get your trademark clearinghouse data validated, you can, the subscription period is 1 year, 3 years, 5 years. And so then if you purchase the 3-year subscription, you can rely on that data for 3 years instead of having to do this over and over and over again. And I believe the trademark clearing people are in the vendor area, and they're all very nice and helpful. So if you have further questions, I would definitely suggest that you go find them.
I was just looking at the guys over here offline going, oh, so much information. And I'm writing it down because the interesting, just like I said with Tony, I get to be here every time. We've never had this particular discussion. That's what I love about this. I mean, you can just keep coming back and you think you're going to hear the same thing. So I'll just kind of get in my computer and all of a sudden you're like, what? I didn't hear that one the last time I was sitting in the fellowship room. So that's why I always ask you, and I've been not wanting to embarrass those who have been on their computers, but that's why I always ask you to put the computer down and just put your ears on and put your eyes on the presentation, because that's when you learn. Amazing, great stuff. So, Christina, thank you so much. We have one remote question, if you don't mind taking it, and then I know you need to run. So from Shaquille, let me get this down and back to the other. From Shaquille in Pakistan, does IPC represent only organizations who have their trademarks registered with international organizations, or do you also represent the organizations regionally? Let me make sure I have it right. Regionally or local, in local or region-specific countries, does the IPC launch any awareness campaigns during the sunrise period to protect the trademarks?
No, we have no restriction in terms of the categories of membership. In other words, we don't represent, our members are not only organizations, international organizations. We have individuals who are members who are, you know, single-person enterprises, both as trademark owners and as content owners. We have members that have massive trademark registration portfolios. So it's really both ends of the spectrum and, frankly, everything in between. In terms of outreach, we started to, when the first new GTLDs went into Sunrise, we started trying to put together some kind of news alert. And we rapidly realized that there was no way we were going to be able to keep up. What I would suggest, though, if this is an area that you're interested in terms of getting notifications, and it's more that you would actually have to go and access the information yourself, ICANN has, in the new GTLD microsite portion of its website, a TLD startup page. And what that page has is when a new GTLD registry, it's signed its contract, it's gone through pre-delegation, it's ready to go live, the registry is required to submit to ICANN copies of all of its registration policies, including its Sunrise registration policies, and identify the dates when its Sunrise period is going to run, as well as when its trademark claims period is going to run, as well as the type of Sunrise it will have. And what I mean by that is Sunrise has to be 60 days, but there are two ways to do it. You can either have a start date Sunrise, which means that there's a 30-day notice period, and then a 30-day Sunrise period. And during that 30-day Sunrise period, the Sunrise registrations are handled first come, first serve. The other way to do it is an end date Sunrise period, which means that there's a 60-day period from start to finish. The registry takes in the applications. They don't allocate any as they come in. After the Sunrise period's closed, they go through and say, okay, we've got 50 Sunrise applications or 5,000 Sunrise applications. None of them are identical. Everybody gets registered. Or, as I found out, they will sometimes get a situation where you have two trademark owners who have valid competing rights in the same mark, which happens in the real world. There's no reason it shouldn't apply in the internet. And so what they'll do is they'll say, okay, everybody else, you get your Sunrise registration. But you two, you have a week to figure out which of you is going to get this registration. And if you can't resolve it between yourselves, then we're going to have an auction. So in any event, on the TLD startup page, they will list all of the Sunrise information and all the registries for which ICANN has received and approved that. So that's a really good way to see, okay, here are all the TLDs where Sunrise is coming up in the next 30 days or the next 60 days. I believe the Trademark Clearinghouse also has has a list on their website, but I don't know that there's anyone who actually does kind of a push notification. In other words, it's really something that you have to take on yourself to go and check.
Thank you so very much. Much appreciated. I will take any questions to provide to Christina on email later. So thank you so much for your time. Good luck on your next presentation.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
One of the things we have to learn at ICANN meetings over and over is to be respectful of people's time and the fact that they have to get from floor to floor and place to place. So that is it for us this morning. I looked over the daily schedule, and it's wide-ranging. So with the diversity within this group of your interests, it's really up to you. Are you tending towards the DNSSEC workshop, which is at a more advanced level? So if you went to the 5 o'clock Monday DNSSEC for beginners and you thought that was a little crazy, do not go to the DNSSEC workshop. You're going to be in a typhoon. And that's fine. It's just knowing that you can go to name collision, which is a really interesting conversation to have. Even at this point in the GTLD process, name collision is extremely important and still an ongoing topic of discussion and interest. So take a look at the schedule. Take a look at something. Albert, you're here, I'm sure, a pitch for the Caribbean session today. I know you're off mic, but you can make your way up here, and I'll let you make your own pitch here at the table for that. And that brings me to a point, too. I'm available. The booth is available today. We'll close down about mid-afternoon. The alumni are available, but also your regional teams. So don't forget, you've got your regional VPs or the managers. If you don't have their email address, get it from me, because they are more than happy to help direct you as well. They know what's regionally important right now, what's happening in a region that they really could use some warm bodies to start to listen to and understand more. So if at the last resort you're like, I really don't know, come to me. I'll hook you up with your regional manager and we can have that discussion.
So this is just a reminder for all of the ICANN 51 attendees from the Caribbean. I've been taking attendance every morning at the fellowship sessions, so I see most of you here. But we are having a lunch, a working lunch at 12:30 in the X-Bar. And the objective of that meeting is for all of the ICANN 51 participants from the Caribbean to meet face-to-face, connect, and have some exchanges, particularly between the newer ICANN attendees and other people like Tracy Hackshaw, Nigel Casimir, and several others, Gary Campbell from the GAC, who've been coming to many ICANN meetings, so that the newer ICANN attendees can get the benefit of the experience of the older ones and forge relationships that they can use later on to develop internet governance activities in their countries. So Caribbean Working Lunch, 12:30 today at the X Bar, and that's on the lobby level.
Thank you. So another reminder, there's an internet governance discussion this afternoon starting at 4:30. I know I'm going to be there just from a starter, but then we're going to meet around 5:30 in the lobby to start our next adventure. So have a great day, everybody. Thank you so much for being here this morning.